every once in a while, I find that it's helpful to me, and maybe it is to some others, to pull things down into simple statements. It may take the form of a formula, just to sort of hang on to them. I worked as a therapist for a number of years, and you can't sit locked up in a small room with two or three chairs in it, in which one or two suffering people sit and give you the gift of their agony. Mm-hmm. You can't do that without learning something. And at the time that I was going to leave the agency with which I was associated, they asked me to take a little time and write down some things that that I may want to leave behind, just as I think they were looking for advice or something. Life is too short to try wasting your time giving advice. It's a useless exercise. But to share something that I've learned, and I struggled over it for about 3 weeks and ended up with a few paragraphs. Mostly it was just a diagram or a formula that I had learned from out of the people's agony and out of their willingness to share their agonies. And it was a remarkably simple little thing. I found that words like hostility, guilt, and fear tended to wrap up a very great deal. Much of what they had told me, and where we'd had a chance to experience together, this came under those categories. And I thought I'd share some of that with you. So what you're getting is what suffering people have told me about their agonies and about their situations. So, unfortunately, I have to stand up, I think, for this, because I better work on this board. And I don't like to do that, particularly after being up until 3 this morning again. That's a plug for the star show beginning at 11 o'clock every night. Were you there? I think I ordered you to today. If any of you want to see Jupiter up in the saddle, it's an interesting thing right now. Jupiter and the moon are up there together, holding hands, kind of. And it's fun. Usually the full moon is not worth looking at, I think. Yeah. Everybody who has a telescope hates the moon. I think I told you that yesterday, because it bleaches out the sky. But here, it's different. Everything's different at Holden. Here, the moon comes up from behind the mountain, and you see the craters and things on the moon, detailed not very clearly, because full moon, you don't see them very clearly. But then you see the mountain coming into this, and the trees sticking up against it, and it's almost like you're in two planets at one time, with the trees right from here, half a mile from us, looking like they're part of the moon up there. Now, that ought to get you. 11 o'clock. Get some sleep. Come on out. All right, coming back now to this, I'm going to stand up and write this thing down and just try to communicate what these people told me over a period of about 15 years. At least it's what I was capable of learning out of that 15 years. We start with a word, pain, because pain is a common denominator of human existence. I think that without stretching things too far, I can say that pain is maybe the most common denominator outside of heartbeats or breathing or something of that nature. Everybody experiences pain, and not only occasionally, but constantly. Now, hang on for a moment, and I'll try to prove that, or at least explain it better. If I ask you right now, are you feeling any pain? Most of you'd say no. One or two of you may have a toothache or a headache or something. At the end of the hour, some of you say, yes, these chairs are kind of hard to sit on all that time. Then you may be saying you have a little minor pain. But if you define pain as being the deficit between perfection, or what we would like to have, if things were absolutely perfect, and then the reality of where things are. Loneliness is a horrible pain, huh? One of the very, very worst. You don't have to have a toothache to be experiencing pain, but you can feel horrible pain if you're lonely or if somebody has just ignored you. I forget who it was of my friends who used to say that there are three things that you can do to another human being. The best thing that you can do is love that person. The next best thing is to hate that person, because at least you're recognizing them. Now, the worst thing that you can do is ignore them. It's a way of saying that lack of community and lack of communion is a dreadful, dreadful, dreadful agony, pain. Pain is with us in some form or another, even if it is represented, or it represents the absence of something that we would need or desire. Who was it? Emerson said that we're wealthy in direct relationship to the number of things we've learned to do without. Because if you don't need anything, you've got a lot of wealth. If you got 80 million bucks but you need another million, then you're a poor man. You're $1 million short, and who wants to be $1 million in debt? But pain starts before we're born. Gazelle at Yale University taught us that. Gazelle was sort of a classic, from our time and in this century, probably gave us the baselines for understanding what makes kids tick. He started out writing, I think his first book was A Child from 5 to 10. It was a good one. Then he wrote a book, First 5 Years of Life, or some such title. And then somebody challenged him on that and said, you're kind of through now, aren't you? And he said, no, I'm going to specialize on the first year of life. And so he wrote a book on the first year of life. And then he said, now you're entirely out of business. But they didn't know Gazelle, so he started to take a close look at prenatal life. He got his graduate students, pregnant wives, to come in and volunteer for some experiments. So the gal would be sitting there, 8 months along, something like that, and Gazelle would tell her, now remember, this is an experiment and some of it may be a little startling to you, but you've already signed a waiver on this, so you can't sue me. Too bad happens. And keep in mind, while this is going on, that I'm not an obstetrician. But at any rate, he had behind a screen, he had an assistant with a big Chinese gong. He told me once that he rented this from the Boston Symphony, because they use it in one of the Tchaikovsky things once a year for one bang. Like an atomic explosion. The rest of the time, this thing is for rent cheap. He had that in there, and it's a horrible sound. I've heard the thing, and it is, in a small room, it is horrible. At a signal, with a girl not knowing what in the world was really going to go on, at a signal from Gazelle to his assistant, this bong went off, and she got horribly disturbed by it. In America, well, who would? So her pulse rate went way up like this. And then it started to come down, as he explained. I'm sorry that I had to do this to you, but we're trying to learn something about your baby in there. Because at the same time, they've been taking the pulse rate of the baby. Baby does the same thing, not so high, but it goes up a bit. And then it came down. Then he said, now, I'm going to do this again, but this time you can watch it. So. He took the screen away, and then signaled the assistant, and boom! This time she startled, but not quite so bad. It goes up like that, and it comes down very rapidly. The baby, on the other hand, said, "Wow, here we go again." So it goes up there, and the third time it went up, and it stayed up quite a while before it tapered down. Makes you wonder a little bit what happens if a pregnant couple stands screaming at each other.
That's right.
Where you have not only the sound, because babies can hear, but you also have the altered chemistry, the chemistry of anger and of fear and all those things circulating through the bloodstream. We talked about that a little bit the other day. But so even a baby at that age can feel, before birth, feels pain in this kind of a definition we got. There's a thing that you can say about pain that is just universal. This is always true. And that is that if you experience pain, you become afraid. Fear is a constant attendant of pain. And that just makes good sense. See, pain is not a bad thing. We ought to sing the doxology over pain. If we didn't feel pain, we would be in a bad shape, if we were incapable of it. Any of you who have seen lepers in some of the impoverished nations of this world may have seen, for instance, feet that got burned in the fire at night in the huts, because leprosy may involve an anesthesia in the foot. The toes might get cooked during the night, or they wear out their toes because also in leprosy they get a drop foot. It doesn't work like our feet, but it just hangs down there. And they scrape off their toes. That's why leprosy doesn't rot them away, but they scrape them away or burn them away. Now, so one of the horrible things about leprosy is the inability to feel pain. Dr. Brandt at Vellore Hospital in South India, a good, fine Christian doctor, though he came out from England as a general practitioner, became the world's pioneer tendon and nerve transplant man out of his concern for these people. And he went and built a shoe factory at Vellore out of old automobile tires, and found a way of making shoes that they could wear that also kind of laced up the foot so that they clumped like this instead of dragging their feet, and then they had this stuff so they could step on rocks without tearing their feet. He also made gloves, and they couldn't understand why in the world the doctor was so anxious to get a hold of some leather to make gloves. But he did that so that if they turned a key, for instance, or something else, handled something. You and I, if we tried to turn something that stopped and it, put enough pressure on it, it's going to hurt. But a leper may not feel that, and they damage the tissues because of it. So pain is a good thing. It's God-given. We should be thankful for the ability to feel pain and not just say, "I'm feeling pain, it's a horrible thing." Pain tells you something. It's a warning sign. It's designed to save you. It is not designed to destroy you. Fear is the same way. Fear is the multiplier of pain. It makes the pain worse. Because often we can stand the pain, but if it's multiplied, then we do something about it. You get a little toothache and you say, "I can hang it onto this." The pain is trying to say, get to the dentist to save the tooth. Now, if you don't get to the dentist, and you don't, it's going to get worse. But you already know that from other experiences that it's going to get worse if you don't do something about it. Because toothaches just don't cure themselves. They have to be helped a bit. So you say, if I don't do something about this, I'm going to have a tooth pulled, and that's worse. Let's do it this way. Let's say you've got 2 units of pain, just to pick a number. It ought to be multiplied by an appropriate amount of fear. that goes along with it. Let's say two units and you come up with four. So now you've got a total pain experience because it actually multiplies pain. You feel worse. Fear itself is a pain, huh? And everybody knows that. It hurts to be afraid. Now, if that's all there's to it, you usually are motivated to go and do something about it, unless you're a fool. Then, of course, you wait until it gets four units of pain, and then four units of fear. Now you got a whopping 16 units or something. There's something that complicates this. Because very often we have something that is fear-related that is called anxiety. And anxiety could be defined in many different ways, but anxiety, one way to talk about it would be to say that anxiety is fear that doesn't know what it's afraid of. If I am, I talked yesterday, I think, about a guy pointing a gun at me, huh? And some of the day before yesterday, chemical reactions, all kinds of things take place within me. If that, and I know what I'm afraid of, I'm afraid the guy's going to shoot. But what if I feel somewhat the same way, but there's nobody with a gun? There's an anxiety. People who walk in a kind of a trembling. We talked a little bit yesterday about the, whether yesterday or the day before or whenever it was, we talked about this dreadful situation of being unable to identify some of the pain and chaotic conditions in our lives and nail them down. In a case of anxiety, we have lost by repression of some things, pushed down into the unconscious mind some of our fears, so we don't feel them. We don't know them. They are now unconscious to us. Psychology 101 for a minute here. Repression. It's kind of important to understand that if we're going to understand this fear anxiety thing. You have different kinds of functions within your mind, huh? And some of it's conscious. Then there's parts of it that are extremely useful, extremely valuable. Without it, life would hardly go on. That are unconscious. And it'd be a terrible clutter if you have to have up in consciousness everything that you knew and had experienced in life all at once. You know, there's no way to find your way through that morass of stuff. So it's possible for us to forget or to push down out of the area of consciousness. Then some of that material you can recall when you want to. If you're not senile like some people, you can call back most things. And some of us can't remember our own names in the morning or even later in the day. I ask my wife once in a while what day it is, and she'll give me the wrong day. Thinking this is going to stimulate or, you know, discipline me into a better memory. Oh yeah, this is Sunday. So I get up and put on everything but a tie, because I haven't had a tie on for 8 years. And in Leavenworth, you laugh. I appeared in a tie once in Leavenworth on the first Sundays, and they asked where the funeral was. But at any rate, it's so easy when you start getting some little attacks of senility. I insist that I'm recovering from an acute attack, and Gertrude agrees with the diagnosis, but not the prognosis. She thinks it's getting worse, not better. But we can recall things if we're not in advanced senility. We can usually pull up most of the things we want. Well, there's somebody's name. We met you 8 years ago. I should remember your name, but I can't. That's a little different. That's sunk down a little bit too far. But there's another kind of material that gets down in there, and that's stuff that we push down. And this is really what we mean by the repressed material. These are things that we just don't want to have into consciousness because it hurts to think about them. Or we don't want to deal with them today. Two kinds of people in the world. Those who hear alarm clocks and those who don't. Now, if you are a person who hears alarm clocks and hate them, I can tell you how. I'll guarantee for $50, I'll train you not to hear alarm clocks ever again. It'll take only 1 week. $50. Now, all you have to do is when you wake up and the alarm clock goes off, reach over and turn it off and go back to sleep for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. Do that 7 days in a row. You'll never hear an alarm clock. What? Because the unconscious mind, which is the only one you've got when you're asleep, that's the definition of sleep, isn't it? You're unconscious. The only mind that you've got functioning when you're asleep is your unconscious mind. Your unconscious mind isn't a dark swamp down there. Your unconscious mind is a very active, alive sort of a thing. And at the end of 7 days, if you're reasonably intelligent, I turn down people who aren't, because sometimes it takes 10 days. They get you charged for it. But you just push this thing out of existence, and after a while, the unconscious mind says, this guy doesn't want to be bothered by this. Let him sleep. It's kind of like a mother. A mother may, for instance, let's take an extreme one. Let's say she lives along the elevated trains in Chicago, in a tenement apartment. And the trains come roaring by there all night long. And some of them come so close to some of those buildings that they almost knock the corner off the building coming around them. And a mother may be fully able to sleep right through this train roaring through her bedroom in the middle of the night. But her little baby, two doors down, just whimpers a little bit, and she's on her feet running down the right away. The unconscious mind says the train doesn't mean anything. The baby, wake up, lady. Wake up, get on your feet. So the unconscious mind is a fantastic thing and a great servant. But we misuse the unconscious mind. We hurt somebody, and we know that we ought to get this straightened out. We'll sit down and talk about it. But we say, well, we use all kinds of mechanisms, but one of them is rationalization. We say, I don't think I better bother her today with that, because she's awfully busy today. I'll do that tomorrow. The mind says, hey, out of some kind of guilt feelings over this situation. So unconscious board, the mind pushes this up, and you say, now, she's too busy today. And then the next day comes up again, I'm too busy today. And the day after that, well, this would be a kind of a bad time because we've got these people coming tomorrow. And you do this for a few days and it stays down, sort of gets waterlogged. Then it's repressed. You could do the same thing with a cork or a piece of wood, couldn't you? You keep on, every time it popped to the surface, you pushed it down. Every time it comes up, you push it down. After a while, it'll just get waterlogged and stay down there. Now the material is repressed. These can be guilt feelings, they can be hostile feelings. You take a child in a Christian home will sometimes experience where did that come from? That belong to the village?
Yes. It's been suppressed.
It wasn't here when I was here. Well, I suppose but here, this repression pushes down a lot of hostilities, a lot of guilts, some fears and things, and says, I don't want to deal with them, and they get bogged down there, but they don't disappear. You don't put them out of your mind by putting them into your unconscious mind. You just simply put them more deeply into your mind, where they're not so readily dealt with. And then they become kind of dangerous, because they're buried alive and they're toxic by nature, these things we're talking about. So they can destroy, and they destroy by way of anxiety. Anxiety is fear that doesn't know what it's afraid of, because it's the knowledge of that's been repressed. And it comes spouting out in all kinds of ways. Like, for instance, I get a little pain in my stomach. And if I have enough of this junk, garbage, that I've repressed down here and not dealt with, then I can make a big thing out of this little payment scheme. A common one is, maybe I've got cancer. Cancer, you know. Big wiggly letters, cancer. And it all was because I've got a Norwegian stomach and I eat sauerkraut and wieners. Exaggerate. Now, what happens if you have anxiety? Let's write it in here. If you have it, well, you can't read that, so that's all right. But anxiety, if you have it, it demands expression. So you try to find a hook to hang it on, a satisfactory explanation for the way you feel. Dr. Reinierson, a generation back, one of the greatest of the internists in the United States, was on a program that we had at Mayo's for doctors and pastors one time, and had Dr. Reinierson in to speak. And over coffee, after his hour, during which he had explained that he had reserved for himself the awesome responsibility of reporting to all the people who came through his department the results of their examinations if they came there with suspected cancer. And so he thought that he probably told more people than did any other doctor in the United States at the time that they either had or did not have cancer. And I, doctor, it must be a horrible thing to have to tell so many people that they have cancer. Oh, he said, you don't quite understand. He said, that's a terrible thing to have to tell somebody that they have a life-threatening disease. But it isn't as bad as telling the people who come here that they don't have cancer. Well, how can that be? Well, because these people went to their hometown doctor, and the hometown doctor says, no, I know that you think that you might have cancer or something, but the results of my examinations, there's nothing there. You're very healthy. Don't worry about it. But you still have some kind of a feeling that something has to be wrong. And cancer is the best way to explain it because that's the most dreadful thing we know, probably. Huh? It doesn't make any difference if it's a little skin cancer like I happen to have right here. I've had it for 40 years and so I like put a little salve or something on it that helps it a bit. But I'm not going to die of that blooming thing. But cancer is a terrible word, and cancers are coming 800 different varieties, and most of them are curable. But we think of this as a terrible, and it is indeed a terrible diagnosis under some circumstances. But these people would come from their friendly hometown doctor who said nothing's wrong with them. They'd say, well, I hate to do this, but I think I'm going to go over to that clinic in the next town that's a bigger place, and they'll find it. And they go through that. That's a much more elaborate kind of procedure, and they don't find it either. And they say, well, I can't live with this. I'm sure that there's something wrong. I'll go to the university. So they go to the university. Now, this is the best around. And then in a generation back, after they had gone through their own university in, say, Iowa or in Indiana or New York or wherever, then they would say, well, let's go to the very best. They'll find it. They'll go to Mayo's. So now, having been told 8 times as they climbed the ladder from one facility to another, now they're at the place where they get the final judgment on this, and the best in the world. And then Dr. Reinierson has to sit down and say, I've got news for you. We went through all these tests and we were very careful, and there's no evidence that you have cancer or any other major problem. Then he says, stand by to see a human being collapse. Because the last explanation for their agony has been taken away. And he says, that's where I spent time this morning with this group. My colleagues and the pastors that you have here understand that there's nothing quite as dreadful as having the final explanation for your agony taken away from you. This is anxiety, you see, that's speaking. They needed the cancer diagnosis to explain the dreadful pain that they were under. And you take that away. All right. All of us have some of this. Trick is to keep that reduced to a minimum. You get 2 units of pain, but your fear thing, because it draws on the pressure of anxiety and feeds it back into this, and you have 8 units of fear, multiplying this, and you've got 16 units of pain. Huh? Now that's another bag. You should have had only 4. Now you got 16 units instead. So now the whole pain, fear thing gets multiplied into something that may be entirely unmanageable, and you may get into very, very serious mental and emotional difficulties or physical difficulties, because I don't know if you might get cancer, but it's certainly not been established. But you can sure rack up your health if you're living in a constant state of exaggerated fear or anxiety. It's a dreadfully devastating thing on human tissue and human chemistry. All right, now, another thing that these patients taught me about this is that any time you feel pain, you experience hostility. No escape. You just do. If you hurt, you hate. You see this in a child very clearly, don't you? A little harder to see it yourself. But you see it in a child. Kid goes running through the, a toddler comes running through the dining room and bumps his head on the corner of the table. And the table hit me, obviously. Primitives do the same thing. They trip over something in the jungle, a log on the trail, and it was the spirit of that log that bounced the log up to trip them. Well, you see, that's childish to that. If I would walk with my little grandson, say, or something down the street, and we would both trip over a crack in the sidewalk, and we both fall and both skin our knees, I could predict that our behavior in response to this would be quite different, except in essence. The little kid would say, sidewalk, right away, direct. May stamp his foot at it. That means sidewalk. I wouldn't do that. That'd be embarrassing. Imagine a grown-up man standing there and saying, sidewalk. No. I would. Well, first thing I would do is look around and see if anybody saw me. Then I would scrape the dust off and hope the trousers weren't torn. I might pull it up to see if it was bleeding. And then I'd say, no. Why in the world we pay these taxes? These guys running this town can't keep the sidewalks. Same difference. You can project it then into a little different situation, and it's respectable. It's perfectly respectable to even assign that to some sort of maturity to blame government or somebody for these things. And fortunately, they're around for that purpose. I think that's one of the chief functions of government. To soak up the hospital, to give us a place to throw it. Because what's the alternative? Your wife and your kids. The government is, we ought to pay. There ought to be a separate rubric in our tax forms where it on that local form, where you pay for roads and you pay for schools, and there ought to be another place, for the privilege of raping. We ought to be willing to pay 25% more or something, but let these guys absorb it. And they handle it fairly well, I think. Then you can always vote them out of office as a great final weapon. Usually hostile. Now this always falls, because there's something about pain that is insulting in its more profound sense. This is an intrusion into us that is unwanted, and we think intuitively that it is wrong to feel pain. Not to feel it really, but that the situation is there that makes introduces pain. There should not be. We still think we deserve Eden before the fall. There is something hidden way down deep inside of the psyche of human beings, I believe, with Carl Jung, that remembers paradise, remembers that day that we walked. And anything short of paradise tends to reflect itself in behavior that is influenced out of this feeling of that something is wrong, this dis-ease that comes when you know that you were created to walk with God. And somewhere or another there's pain, and how can this be at the same time? So we get mad about it. Maybe that's even, I think I would rather that we did have some hostility with pain than that we didn't have it, because we might draw a line across here and say that's the end of it. And we might kind of be reconciled to pain. There are times when this is good. One of the most exciting things that's happened in modern medicine is their discovery of ways to alleviate pain, not by drugs, not to actually lower the pain, but to increase the tolerance of pain, because some people have to live with it. And there's some amazing things that have happened. People have learned to tolerate pain. Now, one of the things that's happened is that they have canceled out the fear part of this. That's one of the chief mechanisms that's being used, is to get people over their fear. So now you get two units of pain here, multiply by two of fear, period, that's it. You don't get this 2 times 10 or whatever, or a bigger thing, because you've explained it away. There's no great fear that it's going to get much worse or that's going to destroy me. They even work then at deeper levels of getting rid of the anxiety component that's in this, and then the result of the pain is reduced. We can learn to live with pain to an amazing degree, particularly under some of the modern treatment methods. And fortunately, in a time when more and more of us live to the place where we might get into untreatable diseases or conditions, it's good that a big advance has been made in the matter of pain. Now, the hostility thing, that gets us into trouble. We become afraid. If I do get mad, if I have a hurt, no matter where it comes from, and I become hostile, and I am clumsy or immature in handling and channeling that hostility that results from my pain, I might deliver the hostility and express it to my wife. Well, that's a dangerous thing. She may just forget to put the coffee pot on the next morning, you know, in retaliation. Or she may not fix my favorite food that week, or you know, whatever. More seriously, if we experience hostility, it has to be expressed. If it is expressed towards some other person, or even in some cases, impersonal things. We are afraid of retaliation. Well, why not? If I hit somebody, if I've got any sense at all, I'll duck. I ought to be afraid of retaliation. Otherwise, I'm just stupid. You just don't go around delivering your hostility around without expecting it to be returned to you. Chief function of husbands and wives, by the way, is to accept the hostility without bouncing it back. The problem of being married is that very often you're at the same agenda, same time. I've got some hostility to throw at my wife, and she's got some out of her pain to throw at me. And so we use each other, and it gets to a war, not a, you know, not a. But if, as usually happens in our house, I get mad, and Gertrude smiles a little bit and turns her back and ignores it and lets me scream a bit or whatever, then it tends, because it was accepted. It's kind of like taking a steel ball and throwing it at a steel wall, you better duck because it's going to come back at you. But what if you throw it into a box of cotton that accepts it? What happens if, for instance, you throw it at God and say, there's one guy that I introduced you to, damn you, God, and find that he just throws his arms around you. You know, then you can reduce this process. You've stopped, you broke it into it, you've cut into it. If you can find somebody that can accept your hostilities, you're going to be less hostile. It's the only way in which it's reduced. All right, now, fear of retaliation is an important presence here. Then you move past this. There's another thing that always happens in hostility, and that is guilt. It's impossible to hate under any circumstance whatsoever without experiencing guilt. You may experience it on an unconscious level, which means that you're not aware of it, but it's there, and it's operating, and devastating yourself. It's interesting that one of the great old classics in anthropology was written by Fraser, an Englishman, the book's titled The Golden Bough. They're magnificent. I was much intrigued by Fraser's contention that the universality of guilt is in response to the personal hostility. He just says it's ubiquitous. It always happens. Except, he said, for one little group tucked away down in the South Pacific on the island of New Guinea, the Papuans, cannibalistic people, can go through this, what he thought was the ultimate hostility, eating, you know, the person, without feeling guilt. So that's the only time he'd ever seen it. And he sort of hints that these were because these people were of this lower order or something, they hadn't quite, not quite human, perhaps. But he states it as a very interesting phenomenon, that here were people who did not feel guilt at all. And, well, he didn't understand cannibalism at that time. Cannibals are not unfriendly people. I spent a whole night in a cannibalistic village not too awfully long ago. The most recent act of cannibalism had been 3 days before, and I felt perfectly comfortable because they're not looking for missionaries to throw into a stew pot. But this is a religious thing that has to do with don't wasting things. Eat even your own mother or child when become part of ceremonial meals, and they'll pray, for instance, the strength of the biceps and the fleetness of the foot and the courage of the heart and wisdom, things like this. And then the interesting thing is that I happened to be stationed in New Guinea during World War II, right among the Papuans. And I thought, this is interesting. Here I am among the only people that are exception to this rule that hostility always leads to guilt feelings. And I was particularly interested in this because the Ten Commandments that I had known pretty well from the time I was a little tiny child suggest that we really ought to feel guilty, huh, over any hostility. I remember learning that the law came to us in two ways. The law, which being summarized, you know, is the first three about loving God and the last seven about loving your fellow man. And the converse of that is don't hate God and don't hate your fellow man. But if you summarize that once more, you come down to just thou shalt love and not hate. That's the law. Thou shalt love and not hate. Then I also learned that we got this in two ways. It was given rather dramatically to Moses on Mount Sinai on the two tablets of stone, codified. But at creation, he wrote it in the hearts of men. You remember that phrase? Any of you ever learned that one? That we received the law in two ways. At creation, he wrote it in the hearts of men. There's some kind of an intuitive awareness that we are supposed to love and not hate. There's also then an intuitive response of guilt because it's wrong then, you see. So you feel guilty over any hostility. Except the Papuans, and I found myself right in the middle of it. And I'm on several trips later, subsequent to the war, within New Guinea and among these same people, and found, learned very well that they felt guilt just like anybody else, because the last act in the cannibalistic rituals among these people is that they pass a bowl of water around in a kind of a Pontius Pilate washing their hands thing, while they pray that the departed one will not hold this against them, and then they thank the departed one for the virtues that they received in the ceremonial ritualistic. So more eloquently than I've ever seen in any place, the Papuans, that were supposed to be the one exception, are right in the middle of this God-given provision that we showed love and not hate. Now, if we feel guilty because we have hated, and we do, you may again repress all of this stuff, this hostility and guilt stuff. Increasing the anxiety up here is one of the chief causes for anxiety, is repressing hostility and guilt. One of the very chief ones. But if this guilt is here, then we become afraid. Fear again. Every time you turn around, there's fear. Fear because if you're guilty, you're going to go to hell. If you're guilty, you deserve punishment. You'd have to be pretty stupid to feel guilty and say, so what? Either you'd have to be very stupid or Christian. I think we're getting kind of close to something very central, aren't we, to the cross. Some sort of breaking into. But let me get at it in a slightly different way. The opposite of fear. I got to be a different color pen. Pain we're going to have, period. That we're not going to eliminate. To some extent we can modify it, we can learn to live with it. Right now I'm feeling no particular pain. Tomorrow I might be in dreadful pain, so might you, who knows. But fear, now, over here, what is the opposite of fear? I submit that fear is a way of looking at the future. Fear is your posture, and over against what is coming towards you. It's you fear what's going to happen in the next moment or the next year or in the hereafter or something. But you experience it. It's an attitude towards, and an emotion and feeling towards that which you are approaching or is approaching you. I think the opposite of fear is hope. Not that I hope that it's clear tonight so that I can look through my telescope again. That's minorly hoping. That's wishing. Huh? Hope. More like my hope is built on nothing less than Jesus and his righteousness. Huh? Or Paul speaking about this progression towards hope of rejoicing in your tribulation, but you end up someplace along the line capable of hoping instead of trembling and fearing. Hope is the ultimate assurance. It is to say, it doesn't make any difference what in the world's going on. Ultimately, in the ultimate sense, nothing will be able to separate me from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus my Lord. Now there is a place to stand. Now I can look at the threats of life. If I really believe this, that nothing, not life or death, or anything in either one of them, can separate me from the love of God in Christ Jesus my Lord. Now I've got a place to stand. Now I've got a ground upon which I can walk. And life can throw the worst that it has out of this chaos that we talked about at you. And you can say, well, you kind of spit in the eye of it in the end. Death be not proud. You remember John Donne? Death be not proud. For death you shall die. We know that as Christians. Huh? It's death that's going to die. And we're going to live. That's the meaning of the resurrection. That's hope. So, for this dreadful thing that psychologists and others and my patients would have said, one of the very worst things that can happen, hope cancels it out, or at least substantially reduces it. The opposite of hostility. Well, I suppose if you looked up in the dictionary, it would be innocence. But when you're either guilty or you're either, innocence. I'm jumping down to guilt already. The opposite of hostility would be love. If you love instead of hate, is that easy enough? Love. Now, what about the guilt? What's the opposite of guilt? Innocence? If it is, it has eluded me. I can't catch up with innocence. I am guilty. And no matter how I slice it, I come out guilty. But there's an answer to that, an intrusion into this process which is natural in the natural man. A sharp intrusion. And it is the person of Jesus Christ. The Christian faith, I suppose, could be defined in many, many ways. But I would like to suggest that the best definition is that my faith consists of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Not with a bunch of definitions or books of dogmatics or doctrines, but it's a relational, a relationship with God in Christ, and that which results. And one of the things that results is the forgiveness of sins in this Christ Jesus. Now the guilt. Why do we stand around trembling about something that's been taken care of? Remember Zorba, I suggested the other night? Suggesting that God gets awfully tired of hearing us sniveling around and reciting our sins like they were a bunch of rose beads on a rosary or something. Your mind. Live in this relationship with Him. And the guilts fall into place as forgiven. And we celebrate the process of the erasing guilts and the erased guilts. And then I don't have to worry about whether I confessed my sins this morning if I died this afternoon either. Because I am forgiven every time I take a breath, every time my heart beats, every time a cell moves within this magnificent process that takes place in human life. We live in the forgiveness of sins. We don't somehow or another achieve it by some acts of something or other. If we stand in personal relationship with God in Christ Jesus. So, down here, the answer to my guilt is, we could say, my faith. Faith which is described not in terms of some statements, principles, doctrines, but faith which is essential. A personal relationship with Christ. Kind of interesting. My patients and therapists say there's a great unholy trinity of things that destroy human beings. Fear and guilt and hostility, these destroy. Then Paul comes around at the end of the chapter and says, now by faith, hope, love, these three, and the greatest of these is love. Some of us were talking this morning about that. Where are the differences that ought to be there, for instance, in the health of the Christian community? If this is a reality operating in our lives, we ought to be different. Is it because we don't quite believe it? Is it because we don't apply it? Is it because we think that Jesus has no place down in my gut when I've got an ulcer? Or must I, should I remind myself that I live in Him and the ultimate worries are all erased already? We pick up on our cultural attitudes instead of the attitudes of our faith, don't we? We tremble in the face of death. Why? Because intellectually we'll say, yes, there's a life hereafter, and it's a good one. But if we tremble in the face of it, then we have to ask ourselves whether we believe it or not. Well, we're going to talk some more about, what's today, Thursday? Mm-hmm. All right, then tomorrow we have to talk about death and dying and cremation. My wife wants to pass away and I want to die. And I want to be cremated and she wants to be buried. And I can't understand how you can either bury or cremate somebody who passed away. Well, we'll get at some of that.